this episode of the Sophisticated Property Investing Podcast.
Hang on a second, hang on. So you sat down with the vendor and filled out all the paperwork on one day.
Yeah.
And then you took the investor around the next day and they accepted the property. So you sold it within 24 hours, is that right?
Yeah, probably less.
Wow,
yeah.
That's impressive.
Welcome to Sophisticated Property Investing, a podcast brought to you by Ethical Property Partners, the experts in sophisticated property investment.
Maddie Norwich, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast for this episode. Really looking forward to this interview. Let's kick off with your life before you joined EPP.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks for having me. My life before I joined EPP, I live in Northampton with my husband and children, and I was working in further education. I was teaching an A-level equivalent course, mainly around kind of the physiotherapy work that I'd done in my earlier career. And so in terms of our life in property, we own our own home with a mortgage, but I've always had a love of property, but never really aspired, or perhaps not aspired, never really assumed that we would be able to own any property other than our own home. So yeah, I was working pretty much full time in further education as a teacher.
What made you decide that you wanted to join Ethical Property Partners?
Well, on a personal level, I was looking for a challenge. I don't, you know that kind of feeling when you've been doing the same thing for a while, and the kind of person who gets itchy feet, who wants something new, something challenging to do. And I had been kind of thinking about, you know, what that might be for quite some time, probably a couple of years. Already been thinking about it for a couple of years when I met you, actually, Frank, and. I remember. We had a chat one day at a conference, and you mentioned that you housed homeless people, and that really sort of struck a chord in me, because I've always been really passionate about the issue of homelessness, just based on some experiences my family had as a child, but also more recently in my teaching job, I'd become increasingly aware of the fact that actually. In one of my tutor groups where I was tutoring 16-year-olds who were retaking their GCSEs, I got to know them really well, and it really shocked me to discover that a third of my class of 21 were sofa surfing, hidden homeless. And so when I met you and you said that you house homeless people for a living, it was like, you know, a light bulb moment, or a, you know, a kind of an electric shock moment. You're like, right. That's what I need to do next. And then it was kind of, really, it was a journey in from there to figure out how I could do that in a way that replaced my teaching salary, because we couldn't really be without my teaching salary as a family, and how that really worked, and whether we could, you know, whether we could make it work, and whether that could become my full-time or my, you know, the focus of my work time.
That's shocking that a third of your A-level class were homeless in effect. I know they were, you know, staying with friends, etc. But yeah. Isn't that amazing? Because they won't actually use the term hidden homeless, but they won't actually show up on any statistics, will they?
Yeah, that's correct.
They'll just be completely under the radar, but actually a massive issue for us as a society. And I imagine an issue for you as a teacher trying to help to educate them, because if we're thinking of Maslow's hierarchy of need, that safety and security is so much more important than education and learning. But of course, in the long term, that education and learning is going to be critical for them, isn't it? So you know, I can see how.
It was the awareness that they actually, you know, I'm chasing them to get their assignments handed in, and then I find out that, you know, they don't know where they're going to sleep that night, or whether the friend that they've been staying with will kick them out because their parents have had enough, or you know, some of them were staying in really you know, undesirable locations, or they put themselves into relationships just so they can get every favor they had, but you know, not with a good crowd. And I just think, oh, you know, what is the point of chasing these young people for assignments when they literally don't know where they're going to sleep tonight, or if they go back to the place they slept in last night, they don't even know if all their stuff will still be there, or you know, that kind of home, you know, the security of home that my own kids, you know, take for granted just really shocked me. And I reached a point where actually my children were the same age as these kids that I was teaching. And I think that made it, you know, all the more challenging, the stark nature of the different lives that they were living and how that utterly crushed their opportunities and their potential. So I was really motivated to want to do something about that.
It's a whole different world, isn't it? You and I were exhibiting at a conference down in London a few months ago, and one of the talks was from a panel of four. I don't know if you remember this particular one, but it was a panel of four youngsters. I'm going to use that term. They were teenagers or early 20s talking about their experience. And it had never dawned on me, but clearly it's a massive issue, and you've just touched on it there, that they would enter relationships, really unhealthy relationships, in order to just have somewhere to stay. And that had never even dawned on me, but maybe I'm naive, but you've just mentioned it as well. So clearly that's a massive issue for us as a society, but also for these youngsters. You know, if they're solving the problem of having a roof over their head by entering a dangerous situation or a threatening situation or an unsavory situation in some way, then it doesn't massively increase their ability to, like you say, focus on a relatively unimportant thing in the short term, like education. Mm. It's a big problem. Absolutely. So I get that you were really motivated by that. Absolutely. You run your own church as well, and were at the time with your husband. So I'm guessing you've seen your fair share of social issues through that and support for that, and I know you've got a massive heart for helping your local community, so I'm guessing that was part of it as well, Maddie, wasn't it, your desire to get involved?
Yeah, it was, absolutely. I think I was at a point where you know, Mark and I have been living in Northampton for about probably about 12, 13 years by the time I reached this point. And we had really been wanting to be positioned, you know, in a place in the town where we could be doing good in a more broad sense. And I was sort of feeling a little bit pigeonholed in education and wanting to be networking with some of the amazing people that we'd met and made connections with through our church and faith community, and also wanting to be doing, you know, loads of good in the town as an expression of kind of our faith and our values, and was looking for an opportunity that would see me more strategically placed, as it were. And definitely, you know, that's been one of the most exciting outcomes for me of working with EPP, is that, you know, I've been given tools and an offer that means that, you know, we genuinely bringing something that was missing, you know, that kind of niche of, you know, young people that we talked about, that same niche exists in so many different client groups. And there are loads of really amazing specialist services that can help, you know, those young people with their issues around mental health or around drug use or around breakdowns in their families. And those services are so expertise at what they do, but actually they just don't know the first thing about housing. And so it's really exciting to me to be in a position of being able to kind of, you know, massively plug a gap in the service provision of what those organizations can offer their clients. That means that, you know, people can offer a really rounded service to their clients rather than just having this housing gap, which most of the charities that I work with, you know, have identified that as such a significant frustration, but they have no skill, no expertise and no resource to plug into that to solve it for themselves. And so, you know, literally to be in the position to provide kind of the missing link, if you like, that enables those service providers to give a really rounded offering for their clients is really exciting, and means, you know, networking, you know, across the whole town with all of those different providers, which I absolutely love. I love that I've been given tools and training that put me in a position where I can make a massive difference to all of those different organisations that I'm working with.
Fantastic, Maddie. I'm so pleased for you. Let's focus in on that then. So over what period of time and what have you achieved? So how has that journey unfolded for you?
So I first started working with you in May 2015, which is almost 5 years ago, shockingly. And really my singular focus when I joined certainly was to be sort of running the stepping stone strategy of working with charities who have clients who are disadvantaged in terms of their access to housing, whether that's street homeless or hidden homelessness. I started straight away to network with those charities and seek to find out what their needs were and get orders in. So there was, and it's always hard at the start, isn't it? Because you've kind of not got much reputation to stand on and much credibility. And so it was great for me to be able to use the credibility of the Stepping Stones brand and of EPP and to be able to talk about what had already been achieved by others and to explain that that's a service that I was able to bring to Northampton now. So it wasn't like, although I was starting from scratch, actually Stepping Stones wasn't starting from scratch. And I'm really confident that, that kind of platform or stage, if you like, is part of the reason why I was able to get things off the ground here, because I could go and speak with charities about what was already being achieved and I could use the experience and the credibility that others had already established as kind of a, start on their shoulders sort of thing rather than starting from the ground. So that was brilliant. So I started meeting with charities, identifying their needs and getting to a point where they understood the model enough and were happy to kind of order properties from me. And then I started to use the EPP marketing strategies to find both investors and suitable properties. And it was actually the 4th of June 2016 when I moved my first 4 Stepping Stones clients into the first house in partnership with a local charity who work with 2 main client groups, one of which is ex-offenders and the other of which is low-level mental health problems. And very quickly, they took on a second house from me. And that was brilliant then, because to have a charity who'd taken one and then immediately took another one gave me all of my own credibility to start to secure orders from other charities across the town. So now, kind of where are we now? Five years on, although 4 years on from Housing First clients, I'm running 15 HMOs across my county in partnership with 5 different charitable organisations. Because what's happened is the charities are so happy with it that they order more properties. And they tend to be, or for me, they tend to be the bigger, sort of more regional charities that have taken the orders. But actually what you find is that they're networking with all of the more, the smaller local organisations that perhaps don't have the capacity to have an entire property themselves, but they refer clients between them. So that actually, although it's kind of 5 charities that I'm working with, probably housing clients from probably between 10 and 15 local charity partners, which is so exciting to really go from not knowing a clue about property, which is really where I was, although I've always loved houses and I'm a bit of a freak in the sense that I actually love moving house. In fact, I feel I need to move house right now, but that's a regular occurrence. I've always had a love of property, but really just not knowing anything about the process of property at all. I would pack the boxes and move the kids and really enjoy the opportunity to declutter. And my husband would do all of the process stuff behind it. to have somebody who can sort of train me, really handhold me through those to a point where I'm really competent to do the more regular stuff. But also, even in the midst of that now, every property I come across has something new that I learn, or many new things that I learn along the way. And so I'm really glad that, EPP isn't just a course where you're taught it and then you go and do it, because actually property just wouldn't work in property, because every property is different and every vendor is different. And actually, when you put yourself into a scenario where you're wanting to solve problems for people, and that's a really high value problem solving that you're doing, actually you really need the backup all of the time to be able to make sure that you can solve those problems. You know, what you commit, it's really important to me that I do deliver what I commit to deliver. And I couldn't do that without the support of EPP. I would have lost so many of the deals that I'd done. You know, you'll let you know, Frank, how many times I call you. But, you know, that is part of EPP, you know, that ongoing. You know, we talk all the time, don't we, about playing chess and, you know, and actually only having to know the next step. And I think absolutely in property that's the case, because of variations of what can come up or what can be difficult, just infinite, utterly infinite. And so, you know, I love that there's a system there, and both in terms of training and in terms of support, that I can absolutely put my faith in, and hasn't let me down, and hence, you know, where I am today. And so, you know, we're in a position of running 15 houses, and 10 of those are with investors, but 5 of those are in our own portfolio. And every day, you know, that's a complete kind of like a positive shock to me, you know, that we're in a position that we've been able to build our own portfolio and use our own funds and resources and time to house homeless people under roofs that are ours. I kind of thought when I started that maybe we'd buy house number 10. That was kind of how I thought it might go. But I think we bought house number 4, which was like way beyond.
So you thought you'd have to supply 9 to investors to earn enough to buy one for yourself, i.e. the 10th one. If you've supplied 10 to investors and you've bought 5 yourself, you've averaged every third one, haven't you?
Yeah, so
supply 2, buy 1, supply 2, buy 1. That's awesome. And what a difference to your net worth. That's amazing. Yeah. You don't have to give us figures, Maddie, but I'm sure it'd be helpful for people. You owned your own house and you've been paying your mortgage off very diligently for years. What kind of percentage increase is that for you as a net worth? I'm sure it'd take you a moment to work out, but I just think it'd be useful for the guys listening to have an idea, because you've worked hard for 5 years. You've clearly replaced, I think you said it's just shy of 5 years, you've replaced your income from your full-time employment before, which is many people's goal in property. You now have a passive income from those 5 properties, and we can talk more about that in a minute, but also to have had that impact on your local area, which was important to you from a faith perspective, it was important for you from a community perspective, at the same time as having a significant impact on your net worth, is just it's a very well-rounded improvement in the situation, isn't it? And so what is it as a rough idea, Maddie?
So I just need to kind of note that actually in terms of our own home, we were mortgaged well below what we owned, and actually we were on an interest only mortgage, so we haven't been paying it off, because my husband has always been quite shrewd in that sense, and he's like, it doesn't make sense to pay this off, it's too cheap. So we have to on an interest only mortgage on our own home. We're not paying it off, but our loan to value is really low. But in terms of our net worth, it's probably quadrupled it.
I was thinking it might have doubled or trebled, but quadrupled.
Yeah.
Which is amazing, because whatever your net worth was in year one, you've added that again in year two, and again in year three, and again in year four, and again in year five. That's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. Like when we think of, you know, I'm not going to be impolite and ask how old you are. You have children at uni, I guess that gives an indication, doesn't it? But it's taken
not right
you...
now, actually, they're at home right now.
yeah, absolutely. I'm digging myself a deeper hole, because I'm about to say it's taken you a fair few years to get to that point, and I'll stop insinuating your age. But my point is, it's taken you X amount of time to get to there, clearly much longer than a year, and then you've doubled that in a year, and then you've added the same again the next year and the next year, which is incredible, Maddie. So congratulations and hats off to you. And whilst we're talking about your kids, you've got three sons, haven't you? Three strapping lads. What a difference that's going to make to their futures as well. You know, the fact that they've seen their mum go from being an employee to being a successful business owner, seeing their mum doing great humanitarian work in their local community whilst building a financial foundation for herself and her family, that must have opened their eyes to what's possible for them in their lives, as well as obviously I keep putting my foot in my mouth, as well as like leaving them a nice inheritance is what I was about to say. I'm making you out to be like 85 now. Apologies, Maddie, but I just think it's massive for them. It's absolutely massive for our youngsters, for our children to remove those blinkers from them of academia. We call it the golden handcuffs, don't we, of being in a profession and our expenses catching up with our income and exceeding them often. And what you've done is you've broken those beliefs for them and shown them another way while staying true to your values, while staying true to your ethics, which is absolutely amazing. I wondered if I could ask a favour, Maddie, and I haven't pre-warned you about this, so I'll give you a bit of thinking time. I'd love, and I'm sure the listeners would, to hear a story of one of your transactions. So what was the vendor's situation? How did you help them? Who bought the property, either you or but let's use one of your investors. That'd be a nice example. And then the charity, how did you go about finding them? How did they take the property? Because I think it's all well and good giving the theory, and the episode prior to this, where Liz Strama interviewed me, we went through the nuts and bolts of how it works. But I think it's so valuable to hear a real life example with the actual story and the actual situation.
I'd love to share them all with you because I love the story so much, because for me it's all about the people.
Absolutely.
But that's fine, yeah. Probably the one that springs to mind that is a really lovely one is an order that I had from a regional charity called the Mayday Trust. And they actually ordered several properties from me because they were looking at a new contract where they were trying to, they had what's called a social impact bond contract, where they were to identify young people who were at risk of causing great cost to society without some early intervention. So quite often these are young people where the family situation is breaking down and they're going to be kicked out by mum and dad for whatever reason. Or maybe they've got mixed in with the wrong crowd and they're looking to get away from them. So I had an order from them for a property.
So you took that order before you found the property or the investor, is that right? Am I getting that in the right way around?
Yes, that's correct.
Because I think that's one of the challenges people have is which way round do I do it? And I'm not sure it matters whether you get the charity or the investor first, but it's definitely correct to get the vendor last, isn't it? So that you can move swiftly on the vendors, solving the vendor's problem. So in this instance, you bought on Mayday Trust first. Fantastic.
Yeah. And they'd actually ordered multiple properties from me in multiple different locations across the county. So I was looking for an investor who could have the sufficient funds to buy a property in an outlying town, which is a bonus around here because actually that's a little bit cheaper. And so the pool of potential investors becomes a bit larger at that point. So we were talking more somebody who needed in the region of sort of 35 to 40K funds rather than the normal 65, which it is around me.
So what you're talking about there is your investor's ability to purchase the properties, yeah. So what you're saying is if it's in the middle of Northampton, you're looking at a £250,000 purchase price, £250,000, which means they need the 60, 65.
Exactly.
But if you go out to a suburb of Northampton, the properties are more like 160 or 200,000, which means they need 40 or 50. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly that. Actually, not a suburb, but an outlying town across Northampton. They're really high. And I met a couple who actually I'd known them for a long time, but it sort of came up in conversation that they had been given an inheritance when one of their parents passed away. So not the sort of people who you'd pass in the street and think, oh, they've definitely got 40 £40,000 sitting in the bank account. Far from that. But they knew what I did, because everyone who knows me knows what I do.
And you shout it from the rooftops, don't you? And rightly so. Rightly so.
So they actually approached me and said, you know, could we find out a bit more about it? And so we sat down. I think you actually came along on this one, Frank. It took place in the summer one time when we were together.
Did I really? Yeah. Wow, that's too long ago for me to remember. But I normally come on the first few with any new clients. So, yeah, excellent.
And I picked this one because they were perhaps an unlikely investor. And I think, you know, quite often it's not the people who you think who turn out to be investors. And so that's why I like this one. So they're just a, you know, regular couple. He's an accountant. She's a dementia care advisor. Just, you know, employee. Themselves really love their jobs and work very hard, very diligent people. And they'd come into this money from an inheritance and wanted to put that to good use, both kind of for a social return and also for a financial return. And when anybody says anything like that to me, my ears prick up and I know we're on to a win, because that's absolutely what we can do. And so they placed an order for an investment property with me, based on being able to secure them a 10% return on their investment. And they sort of disclosed what funds they had available at that time. So they were kind of, you know, they were on board, the charity was on board, and then it was time to find the property.
So just to ask a quick question on that. So they said, we want to spend no more than about 40,000,
yeah,
and we would like a return of 10%, which you knew worked in that price bracket as a HMO. What had the charity ordered? That you said they'd ordered multiple properties, but were they looking for 4, 5, 6 bed HMOs? What were they after?
Yeah, they were willing to consider anything between 4 and 6. Lots of the charities aren't positive about the idea of 6 in my experience. And so I tend to do 5s as a minimum, just because of kind of where I am in the country. It needs to really be 5 to get a decent return for the investor.
Sure.
But also it helps the charity to, you know, if you're down to 4 clients in a single house, the charity have got to be putting in a lot of resource to that one place for 4 clients. So actually it's more efficient for the charity to do 5s as well. So 5 is kind of my, you know, my favorite or my, you know, my optimal, I think, for everybody around here. So the charity were flexible. The investor, they don't really, I mean, they know it's an HMO, and I do talk to them about how many people may live there, but they're not attached to the number of people in their property. I would try and really position the investor to keep their mind on the fact that this is an investment they're buying and not a home that they're purchasing. And that's really critical to the success of the process in my experience. So then went to find the property, and this particular property belonged to an elderly lady. I think she's about 89, and she was in poor health, and it was her family home, and she'd lived there really quite isolated since her husband had passed away 3 years previously. And so I went to do... her daughter received my leaflet through her door, and she phoned me on her mum's behalf to ask about my service and whether I could buy the house. And the house wasn't on the market, but they really wanted to sell it. They wanted to move to the coast, and the daughter and the mum were both selling their homes and moving to the coast together into a single property.
Oh, lovely.
And excellent. Just wanting to, you know, give the mum, you know, some kindness, really, and she wanted to be looking after her, and that meant them both selling their properties. So I went to visit them, and, you know, as is the case with a lot of the properties that I end up buying, the property wouldn't have been suitable to bring to the open market. And nobody had cleaned anything in about 3 years, I think. And it was an ex-council house. So in terms of the bricks and mortar and the space, a brilliant property, really sizable, rooms all round, but just in really, really run-down condition. And arguable even whether, you know, even whether it was mortgageable at that point. So we talked to them about what we could offer, with what we thought the property was worth and what that meant we would be able to offer. they said yes. They, you know, they wanted to just, you know, it gave them the freedom to start looking where they were hoping to move to, and it gave them the certainty, you know, that we wouldn't back out whatever happened. And so that was lovely. Did all of the kind of paperwork with the vendor, because she, you know, 89, she doesn't want to be filling in lots of paperwork on her own.
It's quite daunting, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so the fact that we were able to do that really took the stress out of it for them. And then I went to see the property again the next day with the investor, and they accepted it.
Hang on a second. So you sat down with the vendor and filled out all the paperwork on one day.
Yeah.
And then you took the investor around the next day and they accepted the property. So you sold it within 24 hours. Is that right?
Yeah, probably less.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive. and to people listening that are only aware of conventional flipping, where you would agree it with the vendor, you'd spend 4 weeks, 3 weeks, 6 weeks buying it, then you'd put it on the open market, you'd wait to find a buyer, the buyer would then negotiate, etc. You're already, well, you've done in a day what most would do in a conventional flip in 3 or 4 months, haven't you, which is incredible. So excellent. So the investor said yes, presumably.
They said yes because and they were delighted. So they were nervous about the state of the property, but because they'd seen others that I'd done, which is part of the process as they place their order, is for them to see properties that are up and running and been done, they were able to, you know, they were able to sort of trust the process that I was doing, carrying out, and trust that it would, you know, it would work. And for them, it was a fabulous property, Frank, because it actually is an 18% return on their investment.
Wow.
Yeah.
So they'd agreed to, you'd agreed to supply them with a minimum of 10%, and they achieved an 18% cash on cash return on investment.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It is phenomenal. And so we just cracked on from them. I introduced them to a solicitor and a mortgage broker. They got their mortgage lined up. And I think it took us 6 weeks to complete this one, because we did, in the end, actually do a little bit of work to prepare it for the valuation, so that we didn't get into a position where it was unmortgageable or there was a retention or anything, because that would have really slowed it down for the vendor. And that's one of the things that I love, you know, that the system has taught me, is that there's always a way, if you can look ahead and you have the skill to look ahead, there's a way to anticipate what the potholes might be, and then there are always ways to navigate them. And so certainly in this transaction, it was a real joy to be able to just do a little bit of work prior to the valuer coming round, that then it was mortgageable, and then, you know, we were in a much stronger position to get it done quickly, because this lady's health was, you know, really deteriorating, and they were very keen to move before Christmas. Christmas is always such a strong motivator for people to move house. Everybody will move heaven and earth to get things done by Christmas. It's so funny, isn't it? We all put that pressure on ourselves, but for them it meant the world to be by the seaside for Christmas, and so that's what we were able to achieve. Then this property actually needed a lot of work doing. It didn't actually have a full central heating system in. It needed all of its bathrooms refitting. It needed a new kitchen refitting. We had to put a couple of extra walls here and there. And so actually, this property then had a 12-week refurbishment that was carried out after we'd actually bought the property. And during that time, the investor, we have a guarantee for our investors, which is that we guarantee that they will receive 50% of their final return from the day of completion. Well, if you think you were going to get 18%, you know, you're going to be happy on 9% for a few weeks while it gets sorted out.
Absolutely. I've just worked that out, Maddie. If they're putting in £40,000, that's an annual net return, that's net before tax, isn't it? That's what you quote to your investors. That's an annual net return before tax of £7,200 a year, which they would have had those funds in an instant account at 1% interest or something. So they're getting 18 times what they were otherwise getting. So they completed on the property. So how much, a few questions if I may.
Yeah.
So first question is, how much did you spend on it before your investor bought it? So how much did you spend on it?
£1,500.
So you spent a very small amount then, £1,500 while the vendor still owned it.
Yeah.
Okay. And to some people that'll be a real shock, you know, how can you do works to a property before you own it? But we've got tools for doing that. In fact, we aim to do as much as we can whilst the vendor owns the property, even to the extent of letting it out. Have you done one of those before, Maddie?
Where I've had it on a lease, a fully internally repairing lease before I even own it.
Before you've bought the property. And then, of course, you got zero void after completion, which is brilliant. So you did £1,500 worth of work. Then you did, and I must say, to get all of that done, moving walls, new kitchens, new bathrooms and everything, new central heating in a 12-week refurb is pretty impressive, whilst the investor owned it. So you'd explained all this to the investor. They were happy with this happening.
Yeah.
You paid them 50% of their return, is that right? So they were getting like a 9% return, which is still phenomenal whilst you did the works.
Yeah.
So what was your total spend in terms of the 1500 beforehand? I know you pay vendors legals and the investors legals, and then obviously you've spent all this money on the refurb. What did you spend in total?
22. Okay.
Total spend of £22,000. Yeah. Okay, great stuff. So how did you make money on this? So obviously the vendors accepted an amount. Do you remember what the property was valued at?
Yeah, 132,000.
You're good with your numbers. I hadn't even warned you about this. Had I? So it was 132,000. So that's what the investor paid for it.
Yeah.
And what did the vendor receive?
90,000.
They received 90,000. So there's a difference of £42,000 there.
Yeah.
And you spent £22,000. And that was the totality of all your expenses, yeah? £22,000.
Yeah.
So you cleared £20,000 from that that flip without even owning the property.
Yeah.
And how many charity clients, how many homeless people are now housed in that property each month?
So it's a 5-bed HMO.
Five beds. You got five people in there.
Yeah.
That's phenomenal. And do you manage it for the investor? Do you look after it for them?
I do manage it for the investor, but that's a very arm's length management, that one, because it's now leased to the charity. And so I'm liaising with the charity, making sure that we're maintaining the requirements as per the HMO license, and just helping them with anything matters arising around the structure and things like that, because the lease is internally repairing. That being said, actually, I have an agreement with all of my charities that they use my preferred supplier, so they work with my builder, so I actually get to hear about the internal repair stuff that's happening, as well as anything that the investor is responsible for. So yeah, I manage it.
Oh, excellent.
And then I receive the lease payment monthly from the charity, and then I do a reconciliation around any maintenance that's happened, and I send the investor a payment once a month into their bank account, which I just did this morning, actually.
Oh, really? What a coincidence. And how often do you go visit the property?
It depends a little bit. If something, it's probably less than once a month and more than once every 3 months.
Really is arm's length for you, isn't
it? Absolutely,
in terms of one rental payment a month or one lease payment, one statement and corresponding payment to the investor, and then a visit once a month or slightly less. Fantastic. And do you mind me asking, what do you net from that? What do you charge as a fee for that? How much is that? Is that £100, £150 a month, something like that?
So I charge 15% management fees on all of my properties, because I think I do a lot of work to get them set up and working.
Yeah.
And obviously if I'm managing them more directly, then there's a lot of work and maintaining that relationship with the charity and the investor. So actually on that one, I make £175 a month.
Which is fantastic for what sounds like an hour or two's work a month. That's not a bad hourly rate, especially given that you've got 15 of these on the go. So that's, and some of those you own, where obviously you're the investor, aren't you? So you're also getting that return. I'll ask you about how your cash flow situation has changed a little bit later, Maddie, but how long has that now been operating, that property?
That one's probably January 17, so 3 and a bit years.
You've said that there's 5 bedrooms in there, so the charity's in control, aren't they, of who lives in the property, so they could put the same people in there for the whole 3.5 years or however long the lease is. Do you find that's the case, or do they typically have people moving in and people moving out? How do the charities generally use this property that you're providing them with?
That's a great question, and actually there's significant variation, but I think for me, the thing that we came to realize, or that, you know, I've come to learn, is that actually the charities are the experts at knowing their clients, but we're the experts at housing. And so we make it really clear to them that actually we don't place any restriction on either on how short or how long the person can stay in the house. So I mentioned earlier on that my first clients moved into the house on the 4th of June, 2016. There are actually two clients who moved in on that day who are still in the Stepping Stones house now.
Wow.
But also there are clients, I think our shortest stay has been a couple of weeks, because our properties are actually are classed as temporary accommodation. One of the really massive bonuses for the clients who live there is that they can still stay on the council housing list whilst they're in our properties. And obviously, if something that's, you know, their own home, a flat comes up or a bedsit comes up with the council, then they're in a position to be able to take that really quickly. So they can stay on the list for council housing. And when it comes up, they're in a position to be able to accept it quickly, which is really important. And that, you know, that applies to a significant number of our clients. For whatever reason, they won't ever be in a position to own their own home, or they might never be in a position to rent something privately. So that's a portion of the clients. Then lots of our clients actually, you know, once we plug this housing gap for them, lots of them are really motivated, and they get jobs, they end up working, they're not paying their rent from housing benefit anymore, they're paying it from their own earnings. And actually it doesn't take long for somebody to be in that position, for them then to be in a position where they can rent something privately. And, you know, where they perhaps have been street homeless or sofa surfing homeless, once they've been staying with us for a few months, we often support the clients to save a deposit. So they kind of, lots of the clients overpay weekly on their service charge, on their bills money. And we use that to save up a deposit for them, which gets returned at the end. And they can use that as a down payment for a private rental. And we can also give them a landlord reference, a tenant reference, which gives them, you know, opens loads of doors for them into the private rented sector. So some of those, you know, if they get a job quickly and they get on their feet, then I'm just be with us for a few weeks or a few months. But there are circumstances where, you know, a Stepping Stones house is genuinely the best place for somebody a bit longer term. And, you know, I'm not an expert in every client's different needs and different backgrounds that would dictate those sort of things. So we do absolutely put that in the charity's hand to decide. We equip them to help people to move, and we support them to help people move when it reaches that point. But we don't ever place any restrictions on the duration that somebody can be in a Stepping Stones house.
Fantastic. And it's interesting, isn't it? Before that whole answer, I'm sure people were thinking, well, if people are only in for a short period of time, that's a negative thing. But actually, if at the start of their stay, they're unable to access a letting agent's property, you know, a one-bedroom flat or something, and then just a few weeks or a few months later they are able to, because of those reasons, you know, they've got a deposit, they've got a landlord's reference, they've got themselves a job, then that's a brilliant success story. And of course it frees up that bed in that property for the next person, which is counterintuitive but massively positive. So that's fantastic, Mandy. I know now you are heading up Stepping Stones nationally for Ethical Property Partners. Yep. If there are people listening who are involved with charities, would love for their charity to be able to access property but aren't in a position to buy it, would like to partner with EPP anywhere across the country, or if there's people listening who would like to get involved as an investor, would like to buy a property, and again, we can do that on their doorstep around the country, or indeed if there's someone who's wanting to sell a property and would love the knowledge of knowing that the property is going to be used for this really worthwhile cause after they've sold it, how can people get in touch with you? How would you prefer them to get in touch with you, Maddie?
Yeah, great. So there's a couple of really easy ways to get in touch with us. Most people are on social media these days. So the easiest way is probably on Facebook. We're Stepping Stones Housing. And you'll read the stories that I've been talking about today on the podcast. So you'll know you're in the right place. You can drop a message from there, or you can leave a comment on a post and I'm happy to get in touch with people. Or we're Stepping Stones Housing on LinkedIn as well. Or if you've been snooping around the Ethical Property Partners website and you look at our community work, then there's a Stepping Stones webpage there, and there's an opportunity to drop us a contact on the webpage. So that's ethicalpropertypartners.com/steppingstones. Any of those ways will get in touch with me, and I'd love to, you know, chat to people for any of those reasons, whether they're a charity or even if somebody knows of a charity in their town, you know, that they think that might work for. You know, none of this is any hard sell. We're looking to help, so drop the name of a charity you think might benefit, and I'm happy to pick up the phone and hear about what they do and hear about how we can help plug their housing gap. So yeah, there's multiple different ways: Facebook, LinkedIn, or directly through the website. It'd be lovely to talk to anybody in those shoes.
Thanks, Maddie. I've made a note of those. We'll pop them in the show notes, guys. You've got Stepping Stones Housing on Facebook, you've got Stepping Stones Housing on LinkedIn, and you've got ethicalpropertypartners.com/steppingstones. So we will put those in the show notes if you want to get in touch with Maddie. And Maddie, I just want to wrap up by saying thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Thanks for sharing your really emotional story. It's so encouraging. And I know you act as a role model for many of the partners on EPP in supporting them to do Stepping Stones and supporting them to grow their net worth. And I just want to wrap up, Maddie, by asking you the question that I promised I'd ask at the start. In terms of your salary, when you left your employment, your goal was to replace that salary. How have you got on that journey?
So I actually stopped my teaching job 8 months into my journey with Ethical Property Partners. I hadn't.
Oh, so you piggybacked on it, did you?
So I did. I carried on basically for about 8 months doing the two until I had orders from charities and orders from investors. And once I knew the date, my first two transactions completed on the same day. And that pretty much coincided with me finishing work, knowing that I needed to be really free to get those refurbs pushed through and to be available to those charities who were looking to house their clients there. So we had a bit of what we would call a hungry gap or a faith gap in our language for a few months, which we were comfortable with. And then very quickly were able to kind of reshuffle our own finances and how we did things at home to just mean that this could be my full-time job. Yeah. So very quickly, fantastic. eight months transitions and then over onto this.
So it took you about 8 months. And how does your monthly income compare now to what it was then in terms of everything through EPP, et cetera?
Well, it's just vastly different. it was quite straightforward before, and I was able to keep tabs on it at all time. So now it looks like, I guess, how anybody's running a small business looks. You know, there are multiple different income streams. My husband and I very much manage the finances of the business together. We have a fortnightly meeting where we look at it all and make sure that the right monies are in the right places. And in the really exciting position now of actually, you know, being able to, take money on a monthly basis out of lots of the properties that are in our own portfolio. You know, depending on when we brought them on, one or two are still just paying us back a little bit of cash that we put in, but we can totally see at every point, you know, when that's going to come to an end and when all of that money will be profit. So even now our finances are much better and much greater flexibility. But you know, interestingly, EPP has taught me all about property for sure and taught me how to house homeless people, but the education goes way beyond that to my own personal development in terms of, for me, massively, you know, one of the things has been about my approach to money and how I think and feel about it and whether it controls me or I control it. And that's been, you know, a journey we haven't even approached on today's podcast, but I, you know, so much has changed in terms of my orientation to it. So our life is loads better. Our finances, I have so much better grasp of them than I ever have had in the past or ever desired to have in the past. And I'm really comfortable with that now, which is quite something for me to say. And so we enjoy it now. I do yeah, we actually enjoy now, you know, moving money around and thinking, oh, wow, we can take, you know, £750 out of that account this month. You know, that's just incredible. Like, yeah, incredible position to be in, and an incredible development journey to have walked because of the support of EPP. So I know you said thanks to me, but really it's thanks to EPP and what you've set up. So thank you too.
My pleasure, Maddie. And it's so encouraging. I can hear the emotion in your voice and the excitement in your voice when talking about money. And I can remember not too many years ago, your attitude to, yeah, oh, we've got to talk about finances now. And I don't want to focus on that. I just want to focus on the money. Well, of course, you now know that it requires both to work. I think actually, Maddie, we could talk for another hour about that whole aspect, but perhaps we can have you back on for a podcast episode about your mental journey. That I'm sure I can phrase it better for the actual episode, but your journey in terms of attitude to money, because it wouldn't have been possible without that. You've had to grow yourself, haven't you? You've had to develop and consciously amend how you view money in order to do this fantastic work and to grow this awesome project. So Maddie, thank you for coming on. Really appreciate it. It's been great to chat, and I wish you all the best with continuing to grow Stepping Stones in Northamptonshire, but also nationally. Thanks again.
Thanks, Frank. Thank you.
Sophisticated Property Investing, a podcast brought to you by Ethical Property Partners, the experts in sophisticated property investment.